You're listening to the Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Highmark at RadioArian.com.
Hello, comrades. This is your host of the Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach, and we are here today. It is the middle of the week. We are struggling together, looking forward to the weekend, because of course we know Christmas is only a few days away. It is right there at the end of what will become for many of us a three-day weekend. So let's get together through this week, but there's so much going on, and to help me unpack all the goings-on of the world is my good friend, my comrade, Mr. Billy Roper. Mr. Roper, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Mr. Heimbach. Merry Christmas early, sir.
Exactly. Well, you know, the great thing, being on the Russian Orthodox calendar, is I get two Christmases. I get Western Christmas, and then I get liturgical Christmas. So, you know, it's just like the hobbits and breakfast, right? We get multiple Christmases. But it's very exciting, and there's anything to keep us in the festive spirit, because as Christians, the amazing thing to really understand that Christ, you know, the Logos, becomes man, right? Fully God, fully man, becomes man to come to earth to die for our sins and to be able to fight against the enemies of darkness. Like, this is such an amazing holiday. You know, the presents are great, the cookies are great, the songs are great, the family is great. But, you know, I think we all need to remember the power of what is happening, that human history was forever changed, through what we now call Christmas. But before we get into the fun stuff, I wanted to touch just real briefly on the tax bill. The tax bill looks like it is officially going forward. They have to do one last revote today, over some procedural issues, but it looks like it's going to pass. And on one hand, I am excited that the individual mandate, which of course taxed folks, essentially for not being able to afford healthcare, and that really affected middle class people because they weren't able to get the same amount of subsidies as working class people to get insurance, and they didn't have the money of the bourgeoisie, so they were just really left in a very bad spot. So that's going to be good, I think, for middle class Americans. I mean, sadly, that means millions of people though aren't going to have healthcare, and this is really going to implode the American healthcare system, because the mandate got young people who were healthy to, you know, pay into the system to kind of help out. But of course, we've got this problem in America. You know, these things we might talk about, you know, toward helping old people, helping poor people, stuff like that. We're being forced to subsidize our own genocide. So like all the nice programs that we would have for our people in our own independent nation, we can't really support that much because it ends up going to foreign people who are actively displacing us. But at the same time, it hurts our people. And this is something, Mr. Roper, you've talked about a lot, about balkanization. And, you know, I feel like the situation where there's not enough money, this is a $1.5 trillion tax cut essentially going to the 1%. The middle class is only getting, from the estimate I read, 23% of the tax cut. And of course, we know the middle class are the ones that start small businesses. They're providing local community jobs. They really are investing. Well, these multinational corporations have no problem moving their jobs overseas. They have no problem, you know, pitting workers in one state against another state or country against country. So they're getting the, you know, largest share of this tax cut, and it's going to these multinational corporations. It's not going to Americans. There's going to be problems in the healthcare industry, but there's already been problems, you know, long before the Affordable Care Act. So I just want to get your thoughts about balkanization and kind of what this means, where this tax bill is, I don't think it's going to be very helpful and perhaps even hurt a lot of our people, but maybe this is a pain we have to go through on the path to independence, where we realize we can do better than Washington, D.C. So I want to know your thoughts on this.
We certainly can do better, Mr. Heimbach. I agree with you 100%. As you and I think, would both agree, neither of us are libertarians or traditional conservatives when it comes to trickle-down economics or Reaganomics. I certainly believe that, on the one hand, you know, this bill, as the New York Times editorial, the op-ed this morning, which is entitled, the tax bill shows the GOP's contempt for democracy. Well, I don't identify as a Republican, but I also have a great deal of contempt for democracy. I consider myself to be a national socialist. But in the article in the New York Times, the left-wing rag Will Wilkinson wrote that it's going to add $1.4 trillion to our national deficit over the next decade and pretty much gut Medicare if Congress does not step in to overhaul it and stop it along the way, which they inevitably will. You know, they write these bills and they amend them while they're being voted on, and then they amend them after they're signed into law. It's just what they do. And then there's so many riders that are going to be attached to this bill where they have their pet pork barrel projects and also their hidden agenda that's going to be signed on to every single bill like they always do, where they make their compromises. But ultimately, I think that I would say that this is no more than changing the prices on the menu on the Titanic. And ultimately, people have to recognize, as you said, that salvation for our people, even the best interest of our people, is not going to come from any bill or law passed by Washington, D.C., or by any other national government that's going to be Republican or Democrat or any combination of the two. And ultimately, as a national socialist and as a Balkanizer, as a person who believes that we need a white ethnostate, I believe that as a national socialist, we should take care of our own. We should take care of those among our own who are needy, the elderly and children, and those who are impoverished, and especially white workers. But we need to do that with our people's interest in mind and at heart, not some kind of just blanket civic national socialism or left-wing egalitarian socialism, which is the opposite of what you and I would want.
Well, exactly. And this is what it comes down to. I think you're entirely correct. There's nothing that can be done to really salvage things, because as we know, with changing demographics, the mass immigration that our people are dealing with, not only in the United States, but around the entire world, that all the programs, you know, if you really look at, you know, groups like ACORN that did exist, and the community organizations that exist for other folks, which is great. I like when communities are able to help their own. But, you know, when it comes to like government bureaucracy for programs that workers, for families, you know, mothers with children are eligible for, there actually isn't a lot of support for the white community to know how to be able to properly get into the proper job training, to be able to navigate the absolute, you know, and I say this laughingly as an Orthodox Christian, but the Byzantine nature of paperwork for these American government,
right,
you know, things. Every other ethnic community actually has people to walk their folks through, to help take care of them, get them taken care of, and whites don't have that. So we end up, we're the only population in America that by and large is paying into the system, and every other group is taking out more than they're putting in. So every program, which, you know, is good, and as you said, what we want for our nation, for our people, when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to job training, education, infrastructure, these are things that we're now being forced to pay for other people's. And just like it would be wrong for my neighbor, as much as I like my neighbors, for them to literally come in, you know, for, you know, my family's having our Christmas feast, and take the ham off of the table and take it to go feed their kids and leaving my kids hungry. That's essentially what the American economy and these programs are right now for our people, that we've got the neighbors, these different families, coming and taking the food literally off of our table, to go feed their families. And we're left really holding the bill. You know, we still had to go out and buy the darn turkey, or ham or things like that. So we need to be pushing for independence. It's the only way we can fix these problems, but we also can have a much stronger social safety net. We can have much better conditions for our workers, much stronger incentives for families to have children when we have our own nation. And that's actually, I think, a good segue into the main topic of conversation today, something that you are a relative expert on when it comes to folk traditions and family. Because as we're here in the Christmas season, you know, one of the most important things are our traditions. And it makes me sad. You know, it seems every single year I see less Christmas lights up. I see less, you know, really manifestations of kind of the holiday spirit, because I think so many of our people just feel beaten down and the holiday has become so commercialized, and we've got to be able to maintain our folk traditions of not only Christmas, but throughout the entire year, because that's what bonds us to our ancestors. That's what makes Christmas or Easter or any of the other holidays so important to us. It's not just about stuff and gift wrapping and all that. It's actually this continuity over thousands of years of tradition with our family. So, you know, I want to get in a little bit and kind of let you loose on Christmas traditions, which are so important to us, and some of your favorites.
Certainly. Well, as you know, the people who oppose Christmas they have echoes, right? The same people who want to take the discussion of Christ out of our public schools and want to have the Ten Commandments removed from any public sphere are the people who want to try to set up these false alternatives to Christmas, whether, of course, the fake holiday of the Hanukkah, I have to try to spit in the microphone to make it sound like they do. I can't quite do it. Or whether it's Kwanzaa, which is basically a black prison fake holiday, or whether it's what they call it, Festivus, that was made by the Seinfeld show. All these fake alternatives, these really anti-Christian alternatives to Christmas, were created to undermine and to weaken our tradition as a Christian nation, which the founding fathers were not Hindu or Buddhist or Confucianist. They were all, at least ostensibly, if not deist, then they were certainly, by their own definitions, creationist and Christians. Most of them, majority of them, were defined as Christians. I think that's evident through a true study of the founding fathers and the founding documents. And that having been said, the collective European tradition of Christian heritage and history and culture culminates in Christmas, and that's why it's a target for the Jews and for their allies, for the atheists and our enemies. That really results in things like nativity scenes being removed from county courthouse lawns and Christmas parades being canceled unless they allow LGBT floats and other blasphemies to be included. And it leads to, even among our own communities, kind of internal internecine warfare about the imagery and pageantry of Christmas, which I love so much, and not just because of its nostalgia, because I remember, you know, as a kid, I remember watching the old Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer 1964 claymation movie and all the other classics, Miracle on 34th Street and It's a Wonderful Life. But because it really is part of our heritage and our culture. Now, I'm a Christian identist, as you know, Matt, but I'm kind of, I guess you would say, a little bit loosey-goosey when it comes to some of the Christian identist beliefs. I don't believe that the Christmas tree is a pagan symbol, for example, and we have one in our house, and we're going to be enjoying one at my mom's house with the rest of my extended family, because I've done a little research on this. I just want to red pill some people about the Christmas tree. If you got a problem with it, or you think that it's some kind of pagan, you know, interpretation of the Christian religion, a lot of people don't understand that the father of the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther, was one of the first persons to popularize the use of a Christmas tree inside. According to legend, which I don't think is apocryphal, he actually was walking outside in Germany and he saw the light of the stars coming through the snow-laden fir boughs, and he wanted to recreate the beauty of God's nature as he saw it at that moment for his kids. So he cut down a fir tree and brought it inside and actually wired candles to the fir boughs. And I don't recommend you try that at home unless you've got a fire extinguisher on hand, but that's what he did. And throughout the 16th century, devout German Christians continued that tradition. And then, you know, leading up to 1846, when Queen Victoria of England, who was married to Prince Albert, who was German, she brought that German tradition to England when they were first actually sketched as a royal family standing with their Christmas tree. And because Queen Victoria of England was very popular as a monarch, that tradition began to be emulated throughout England and then throughout the East Coast of the United States. But before then, even in the 1830s, German immigrants to Pennsylvania and the United States were erecting Christmas trees and decorating them in their homes. So I have no problem with Christmas trees or Christmas ornamentation. I actually think it's one of the beautiful times that we celebrate our Savior's birth, as you said at the onset of the program. Now, there was a problem with Puritanism when, you know, the Pilgrims, they established the Mayflower Colony and eventually the Massachusetts Bay Colony. The second governor of Massachusetts, Bradford, actually said that any kind of secular representation of Christmas outside of church was pagan and was punished by imprisonment or fine. The Massachusetts legislature also punished any external outside of church celebration of Christmas with a fine. And they said that even Christmas carols were illegal because they wanted Christmas to be some kind of solemn, almost depressing celebration. But like you said, Matt, you know, to me, there's nothing more uplifting and, like the song says, joyful and triumphant. There's nothing more white pilling than the birth of our Lord and Savior, our kinsman redeemer, Jesus Christ, and what his birth brought to our world. So I don't think it's anything to be solemn and dour about. I think it's something we should be really happy about. And so I don't take the Puritan approach. I think that anything that actually legitimately is joyous and celebrates our Savior's birth at Christmas time is a positive and should be celebrated in that way.
Well, no, exactly. And, you know, one of the interesting things, and this is, we could dig into so much. I love to be able to discuss theology. It's always a lot of fun. Unless it's on the internet, usually. People might get a little excited on the internet. But, you know, right. One of the interesting things is you're mentioning about paganism. You know, traditionally, from an Orthodox perspective, and of course, you know, on our show, we've got, you know, we can have, you know, slight disagreements or just different perspectives. I prefer the term different perspectives because we're striving towards capital T truth. We're striving for justice. We're striving for the natural harmony of the world, right? So we're all on the same team. But, you know, so the traditional Orthodox view in terms of paganism can really be explained. Dietrich Eckart, the ideological founder really of National Socialism, to who Mein Kampf is actually dedicated to by Adolf Hitler. He talks about, you know, how Christian our people already were. And this idea of, you know, truth existed. You know, the scriptures tell us, you know, that truth is, you know, written in men's hearts. So, you know, a lot of the folkish traditions before Christianity that, you know, some, you know, a lot that we've continued in a Christian context, it's not that, you know, as the atheist would say, oh, they just hijacked it. No. It's because, you know, the Holy Spirit moved our people towards truth. And, you know, these expressions, these holidays, these rituals and things like that, you know, were not something that was hijacked. They were continued because they were positive, because they were good. It was, you know, really just pushing towards, you know, the prefiguration of the coming of Christ, of the coming of truth was already there in our people's hearts. So, you know, that's the sort of thing where we can maintain, you know, our traditions that we have, you know, going back to Yule and solstices and stuff like that, then so many of this, much of this has been continued because it's positive, it's healthy, it's, you know, our people communing, you know, with the supernatural and with the physical, building strong families, building strong communities, and really celebrating truth. So, you know, it's one of the amazing things, as you mentioned, with the, you know, the Puritans and the Calvinist tradition. Let us not forget who let the Jews back into England. That really got us, in a lot of ways, into the mess we're in today. It was Cromwell. It was Cromwell and his roundheads that let the Jews back into England, going against Longshanks' decree from several centuries earlier to kick the Jews out of England. He's the one that for money, you know, brought the Jews back into England to benefit his movement. And, you know, the ones that were going then after all the folkish traditions and also Christmas traditions, burning down churches, burning icons, and, you know, banning these public expressions of the faith. It makes a little bit more sense when it's in context of the fact the Jews were let back in and the Jews were really financing this. This isn't a historical theory. This is a historical fact. So, you know, America has a very interesting history because we've got, you know, we've got Lutherans from Germany that came over. We've got Roman Catholics from Poland and Ireland and Italy. And we have Protestants, Anglicans. You know, we've got such a rich tradition. But, you know, as you said, you know, looking, you know, as a Southerner, you know, the Southern people have always been incredibly Christian. Mississippi is still the most religious place almost in the world in a lot of ways. 85% of Mississippians say that religion is a part of their daily life. It's a part of who we are. So as nationalists, we can't separate ourselves from our traditions because that's part of what we're maintaining. You know, biology is important and our blood is something that there's no mulligan on, right? So if you ruin our blood, just as if any people ruins their blood, if, you know, when it comes to animals, when it comes to diversity, if, you know, every single dog became, you know, the proper term being mongrelized, then we would actually lose the biological diversity. So, you know, blood is so important because it's something that must be preserved and it only takes a generation for it to be destroyed. But part of who we are is also our traditions, our customs, the things that bring us together as a family. You know, it's beautiful to me that, you know, in Latvia, they've got very specific traditions. And right next door, you know, in Lithuania, they have different traditions. And in Poland and in the American South and in the American Northeast and in the Midwest, we all have these, you know, slightly different expressions, but it's built on that same principle of faith, family and folk. And that's why we've got to maintain these things. We can't let the Jewish media and these anti-Europeans, because even secular Christmas, you know, they're saying Christmas trees, even if you're not practicing it in a religious way, are offensive. You know, I was looking at pictures from England, and in the airport, they literally had like a barricade basically around the Christmas tree, I guess, so people didn't like tear it down. I mean, it's tragic. You know, our Christmas markets in Europe are having to be defended by barriers so radical Wahhabi extremists don't plow trucks through them like they have previously. I mean, we need to make sure that the physical attacks on us, the you know, when it comes to the media trying to denigrate it, because they hate not just Christianity, they hate Europe. European traditions. So, you know, to my listeners, you know, who are pagan, the thing is, like, our Christmas traditions are also a continuation in many ways of, you know, thousands and thousands of years of European history. They're trying to extinguish every aspect of the unique European cultural experience. So we can't pass it on to our children. So they can shame us, they can slander us, they can attack us, and they can rip us away from these traditions. So whether you're Christian or pagan and you're a nationalist, Christmas traditions actually matter, because the enemies are trying to destroy them because they are a European expression of our folkish identity and our communion with both the natural and the supernatural world.
Exactly. And, you know, Matt, I have friends like yourself who are Orthodox Christian, and I have friends who are Odinist, and even some friends like Matt Hill who are creators. And we agree to disagree on some topics, and some topics we, you know, in a good natured will debate on. But I wanted to take just a moment to respond back and to agree with what you initially said about how some of the folk traditions of ancient Europe, which the Christians discovered already being in place, did mesh so well with Christian heritage and culture. Because we have this common spirit as Europeans, as white people. And it's part of, I believe, our genetics, our DNA, that people who have similar genetic structure, similar genetic inheritance and DNA, have similar proclivities and similar intrinsic values that they inherit. And it's just part of who they are on a biological sense that gives them this sense of commonality and shared culture, even when there's diversity within that culture and they have their own religious or ethnic or national influence, which they, of course, want to maintain and should be maintained for that true diversity to survive, which we all value. But at the same time, as a Christian identist, I would say, as an aside, that I believe that white Europeans, even though they weren't consciously aware of it, subconsciously were aware of their identity as being God's chosen people. Just I'll throw that in there from a Christian identity perspective. But I believe that whether it's religious or cultural, we have this commonality of values, which is part and parcel of our DNA because, you know, culture is a racial construct. You know, race is not a social construct. And society is also a racial construct, not the reverse. So we have this commonality as white Europeans, regardless of our particular religious denomination. Because when people talk about unity, they should always remember that whenever you go to any small town, you're going to see 20 different Christian churches, and all of whom believe that they're the only ones that are going to make it into heaven, right? So we haven't found unity on that level yet. But it's important to remember that we have this commonality in terms of culture and nationality and genetics, which overrides those differences. And this is the perfect time of year, Christmas, I think, to celebrate that commonality and to embrace it.
Well, exactly. I mean, and the sort of thing is that we're a family, and in everything, like, as you know, as the different Christian traditions, as we're, you know, preparing, you know, for the upcoming celebration, for our comrades that are celebrating Yule and different things like that. You know, we've really got to remember this sort of spirit. There is nothing more touching to me. I mean, it's you know, might sound a little goofy, but you know, I remember seeing a few years ago this ad. I mean, it was for like a chocolate company, but it was you know, about the Christmas truce in the First World War, and it actually choked me up a little bit, like because it's so powerful. The power of our holidays and our traditions. I mean, let us not forget that you know there were folks fighting on the Western Front, you know, in one of the most brutal wars in all of human history, with machine guns and poison gas, trench warfare. I mean, this was a horrific war, one that never should have happened, that millions of men lost their lives for, and no one won except for the bankers, as it tends to be when we fight each other. But, you know, one of the most amazing things is to hear, you know, the story of how British soldiers started to sing Christmas carols. And the Germans, in their own language, started to sing Christmas carols. And that brought them together. They got out of their trenches. They put down their guns. And they went forward to one another. And they embraced one another. They shook hands with one another. They played soccer, actually, with each other. And they enjoyed that fraternity. That, you know, the wars that were pushed forward by the bankers, by the elites, by the men that would never, ever have to fight or risk losing a son to this horrific conflict. You know, they're totally kept away from that. But the men that were actually involved, European men that were willing to die for their families, for their nation, were able to come together because of their traditions. And if only for a day, remember that we are, while we have different languages, we have some different customs, we're one extended family. We as Europeans are a unique people. And our traditions are something I think we can rally around. As you said, there is not unity in terms of the sense of everyone believes the same thing. We've got different religious denominations. We've got different European expressions of faith and religion. But if we can remember that we share the same root, that our blood is the same, and that we are one family. You can disagree, you know, if you go to Christmas dinner or, you know, a party with your family members. You can disagree on some aspects of politics. You can disagree on exactly how to raise your kids. You might have different views on the world. But at the end of the day, you embrace one another with love because that's your family. And as Europeans, if we can remember from Russia to England to you know, the Spaniards that are in Latin America, to the Afrikaners and the Boers that are in South Africa, and here in the United States, with the diversity of Europeans that we have, that as one family, if we can come together and say, no, we're not fighting any more brothers' wars, no, we're not going to hate our kinsmen, but instead, you know, raise our voices as they did during that Christmas truce, you know, with a song of joy and of love, and embrace one another as a family. That is how we become the most powerful people that we could ever possibly hope to be, because our unity is our strength. And I want for the European people to be able to look at that model of the Christmas truce and say, this is what our people are going to do from now on. Hungarians will no longer hate Romanians over historical disputes over Transylvania. You know, the French will no longer hate the British. Northerners and Southerners here in the United States will no longer allow our history to define us and divide us, but instead we come together with this understanding that we are one extended family. Even though we might disagree on some things, we should love one another. And the holidays is the perfect time for that. Christmas is the perfect time because we must humble ourselves. If Christ, if the incarnate of, you know, fully God and fully man was able to humble himself into taking on human flesh, that is the most humble thing you can imagine God doing. And it was done out of what? A spirit of love. And if he could humble himself for our sake, we can humble ourselves for our children and our grandchildren's sake, to put away the you know, any of the conflicts of the past, look forward to the future, and embrace one another as family.
Exactly. And you know, everything that you talk about, it makes such perfect sense. And this other topic that's in the news, I wanted to get your opinion on real quickly before we run out of time. When you talk about Europe and European nationalism and World War One, how it began with the ethnic divisions in the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the assassination of Francis Ferdinand, the Archduke of Austria. Right now in Austria, you know, you have this new coalition government being formed, which includes the Freedom Party, which was founded in the 1950s by former National Socialists who were part of the Anschluss, who were part of the New Reich when Austria was reincorporated into Greater Germany. And now the home of Mozart and Strauss and Hitler is now allying with Hungary and with Poland in wanting to keep out the migrants. And that cornflower may no longer be worn by the Freedom Party. But I know, Matt, that you've recently visited Austria and probably on the ground have a lot more expertise than most Americans on what's going on there. I wonder if you'd comment before we close about what's going on in Austria with the new coalition government between the conservatives and the Freedom Party there, and how that Osterreich, how that Eastern Reaches of the Germanic people now may be allying with Central and Eastern Europe to help stop the migrants and save Europe again.
Well, you know, I actually got to sit, you know, Hans Christian Strache is now one of the head members of the Austrian government. I got to sit in his seat in the Austrian parliament and got to meet comrades from several Austrian nationalist organizations while I was recently over there. And things are very exciting in Austria, that even in Vienna, which is one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the world, the Freedom Party was able to get a huge percentage of the local election, that the people are waking up. And as hysterical as the anti-white, anti-values, you know, leftists are, they're losing. they're fundamentally losing the battle because people are realizing that they have an identity. They have a history. And you can see that. You know, I got to go to the Christmas markets while I was over there and get to do some Christmas shopping for my wife and my kids. And to just see these Austrians, seeing their folk gifts, you know, being made, you know, being handmade, and you know, hearing Christmas carols and singing them. And I mean, that strong spirit of nationalism and identity is still alive and it's growing. And the future is going to be, I believe, with Central and Eastern Europe, that this, you know, the land that was under occupation by the communists is now, you know, is coming back to their roots. Because they're seeing that, you know, after this occupation, they're finally liberated to go back to church, to celebrate their national identity and their expressions. And this is, I think, where the bulwark of traditional European values is. And we will retake every inch of European soil. Not a question, not a compromise. That is our land that we will take for our children and all future generations. But, you know, the coalition just goes to show that when the conservatives have to come to the hardcore nationalists and say, we need your help to form a coalition government, that just goes to show that our values are so normal now. They're so mainstream that we have such a large percentage of the hearts and minds of the people that we are the future. The conservatives aren't the future. The Republicans aren't the future. The, you know, the various, you know, center-right parties of Europe aren't the future. Nationalists are the future. So this is a great step for us to be able to see that in Austria, nationalism's on the rise. In Poland, in Bulgaria, in Romania, in Russia, this is the future. And it's going to be able to expand throughout the entire European world because nationalism is normal, natural, and healthy. So, Mr. Roper, thank you so much for being here. I always love being able to sit and talk through all these issues because as one family, this is what we have to do, to love one another, to come together, and to educate our people. So thank you so much, and thank you to my dear listeners. It's always a pleasure. I'm going to look forward to being back tomorrow with another edition of The Daily Traditionalist. I hope you have a wonderful day. I hope you're preparing for Christmas and looking forward to that celebration. And thank you guys so much, and I'll see you tomorrow. Hail victory.
You've been listening to The Daily Traditionalist.